So we're really excited that Dr. Rob Waller is here. He has more letters after his name than I have in my name, and I've got a pretty long name. So he is a consultant psychiatrist who lives and works right here in Edinburgh. He is, I'm quoting from your own website, Rob, he is a fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, holds postgraduate qualifications in teaching and cognitive behavioural therapy. He's an honorary senior clinical lecturer in the Division of Psychiatry at the University of Edinburgh. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and the Facility of Clinical Informatics. I know. How does he do all those things? Most importantly, he is a follower of Jesus. And he's got such an important contribution for us about how the medical and spiritual and Christian truths come together in this important area. I'd really love us to welcome him and to thank him for doing that as he comes to speak to us. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, everyone. I obviously need to sort of tone down the website a bit, don't I? I think. But joking apart, I mean, one of my great privileges is to, you know, I always say I'm sort of, I work for God, but I'm employed by the NHS. And it's been my great privilege to receive training and some of those various things and try and sort of share some of that here, because we just want to really bring the mind and the soul together. So you'll have seen some sort of blurbs out there and stands and so on for the Mind and Soul Foundation. And one of the things we often say is that the most important word there is and. Okay, it's the Mind and Soul Foundation. And what we want to do is we just want to bring together the very best of sort of what we know. We've been studying the brain pretty intensively for at least 100 years. And obviously it also in different ways goes back a lot further than that. And we know a lot. We know how brains work. And then what we find with our faith is we bring in that sort of soul bit about, you know, why brains work and how does the brain relate to the soul or the heart and so on. And we'll unpack a bit of this today. But the most important thing is bringing those together. And the sort of blurb that we sort of put up there initially was the older logo. You may have noticed that our logo has changed a little bit. And one of the reasons for that, as you can see from the slide there, is that we are pivoting to work in working with church leaders in particular. We want to restore leadership. You know, we know that church leaders have very high rates of either overt mental illness, or you will have read about some of the sort of high profile issues that perhaps have arisen in the church out of people not addressing their internal world. So we want to do that. We want to reframe leadership. What does it mean to be a leader? Does it mean to sort of be in control or be busy or be narcissistic? We hope not. It's different things to think about how Jesus was a servant leader. And the ultimate aim of that is to release mission. We want people to be leading in healthy ways, because we know that when people are healthy themselves and lead in healthy ways, mission flourishes. And we've got a number of directors. If you could pop the next slide up there. My colleague, Will van der Hart, bottom right, he works for an organization in London called the Church's Transformation Trust, which is effectively the part of Holy Trinity Brompton who church plants. And one of his jobs is to keep these church plants going, because there's nothing worse than sort of setting up a church plant and they're like super keen and going for it. And then 5 years later, everyone's burnt out and the whole thing sort of collapses. And that's what I mean by sort of releasing mission, because we want to keep those things going. We want to get people who are passionate for Jesus able to lead for the long haul, not a sort of flash in the pan kind of thing. And a bunch of other people we've got there. Arianna Walker, top right there, is the chief executive of Mercy UK, who run fantastic resources. They used to run a six-month residential Christian discipleship program, absolutely free of charge, which is without parallel in the world. And I've been privileged to be on the board of Mercy for a number of years. And I think partly a number of things around the pandemic, people are moving away perhaps from going for a big residential. They want to consume content online. So Mercy and a number of other people like Sanctuary Mental Health, there's a number of other good resources out there for online mental health. And that's why Mind and Soul are moving into the sort of leadership space now. So there's a whole bunch of the directors, and really what we do is kind of talk at events like this around the country. But what we have got as backup is the Mind and Soul Foundation website that we've been growing for sort of 15 years. So there's, pushing 2,000 articles on there. You will find an article on the topic of your interest, you know, autism and Christianity, whatever your interest is. You will find resources on there, which hopefully are good psychology and good theology coming together. And we've got sort of two or three hundred sort of audio seminars. We've got a YouTube channel, whole bunch of stuff. So one of the things I was saying to Chris today, and I really want to sort of honor the guys from the leadership here in the church, is they have really worked with me as well, which has been great. One of the things that I refuse to do is do a hit and run seminar or fill a slot in a preaching calendar or something like that. I'm not interested. This topic is too important and too sensitive to do that. So what we've had is we've had build up. It's been done within their sort of leaders training structure. It's going to have follow up. We've got people on staff who've really engaged. So it's not into a vacuum. And if there are questions that can't be answered by the team here, you've got the website there as backup. Just going to pop the slide up just to the next one. Yeah, please ask anything. Okay, if it's completely random, we might save it to the end, but don't worry about that. But please do ask. There are four resources. There's this fantastic one, which Lisa on the staff team here has been helping plan. This one's free. So that's going to go like hotcakes, isn't it? So go and get that one from the table out there. Really sort of helpful book. There's three other books that you might want to invest in. If you want a sort of overview of the mental health landscape, this is the book to go for. It's got a chapter on what are all the different types of psychological therapy out there. It's got a chapter on what are all the medications, how does the NHS work, that kind of stuff. And it's also got a really good biblical model of the mind, you know, that we have our hearts, you know, which is how the Bible sort of talks about the mind, inside these bodies. How does that all work together? So if you want a sort of biblical model of the mind and a sort of introduction to the landscape of mental health, this is the book to go for. If you want a book that I kind of wrote when I had my midlife crisis in my 40s, this is the one to get. I've written a number of books with Will over the years. We've written one on worry and anxiety, one on guilt and depression, and one on perfectionism and overachievement. We say that's the one for people who are not yet anxious and guilty. They need to read that before they have that implosion. My midlife crisis, I didn't buy a motorbike. I went to live in New Zealand for a couple of years. And anyway, it's a kind of a deeper push into vulnerability and belonging there. And we kind of go through the story of Moses in the Old Testament, looking at his sort of psychological journey, if that makes sense, as he sort of flees off into Midian to be a shepherd to sheep. And actually God wants him to just do a little 5-degree tweak to be a shepherd to people, a shepherd to the nation. Okay, there's a whole bunch of things like that in there. And this, if you want to really get into this, if you want to do a personal journey of transformation or do it with a close, trusted friend, I'd recommend this book. We've just got a few copies out there, but you can order more from Mercy UK. This is the Keys to Freedom course. This, I would probably say, is the most pertinent, relevant, and also evidence-based Christian discipleship course out there. We know that people who do this course improve their measures on a bunch of mental health measures as well. So it's the Keys to Freedom course, and Mercy Now, rather than doing residentials, they do a sort of online discipleship and deep dive course called the Freedom Course, which again, free of charge. You get 2 or 3 hours of therapy a week. You get drop-ins. It's all done online. But if you want to do a sort of 6-month rebuild, the Freedom Course is the one to do. And this one is the one if you just want to sort of do it yourself or study it. And it's hard. It's got lots of gaps in there for a reason. You all need to put stuff in here. So I recommend those three books. Please go and browse on the bookshelf later. Now, just to re-emphasize what Luke was saying, it's absolutely no problem at all with going to the quiet room, because we have got a fairly packed sort of schedule there. We're going to start off initially. I'm going to sort of talk for a bit about how do we get where we are? Okay, where did all this kind of stuff come from? We're going to do a sort of interactive task in the middle, but it's going to be fairly low level. You're not going to have to reveal any personal information or anything like that. Okay, then we're going to talk a bit about managing distress. So that could be distressing behavior on Sunday or emotions in your small group setting or something like that. That will have again, you don't need to say anything personal today, but that will have a slightly more meaty breakout session in the middle of that. And then after that, after lunch, I think we're going to have a testimony and talk about pastoral care in King's Church and how that works. And that will go alongside the pastoral care guide that Chris and some of the other guys on staff here have been developing. Then we'll do a bit of Q&A, and then we'll just have some ministry time. And just to say, it's just normal ministry time. There's nothing special about mental health ministry. It's just music, praying blessings, you know, that sort of thing. We're not going to do therapy, all right? This is an educational event, not a therapy event. So, but there will be some time at the end just to receive prayer, if that's what you want. Okay, how did we get where we are? This picture is a picture that I often sort of start a talk with, just on the next slide there, please. This picture is by Peter Howson, who, this picture I think is in the Kelvin Gallery in Glasgow. It's Peter Howson was one of the Glasgow Boys, a school of artists. And this is a picture of the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyone who's read any of the AA stuff, the 12 steps, generally speaking, mirror the gospel. So first step, I'm a sinner. Second step, I need a savior, or I cannot save myself. Third step, I turn myself over to a savior. Same with Alcoholics Anonymous. First step, I'm an alcoholic. And that's why in those meetings that you've seen on TV, they always introduce themselves. Hello, my name's Bob. I'm an alcoholic, or whatever it is, okay? I'm an alcoholic. I cannot help myself. Third step, I turn myself over to a higher power. And what you've got here is you've got the alcoholic. That's not a very good term, is it? A person who struggles with alcohol addiction would be what we call it nowadays. But call it an alcoholic just for shorthand, who's crawling out from his pit of despair, from underneath the tombstone. And the thing I want to point out to you is he's not looking at the higher power in heaven. He's not looking at God. He's looking at the local church. Okay? And this is why it's so important that as a local church, we've got a helpful, biblical, culturally understanding view of mental health, because people are going to walk into churches with mental health difficulties. And that could be everything through from alcohol dependency or psychosis, right the way through to internal things that you can't really see, but they think they need a something, a God, a higher power, whatever it is, and they will come to the local church. And I remember Bill Hybels always used to say, the local church is the hope of the world. And I still believe that. You know, you're here on a thoroughfare, you've got footfall, you've got all the Boromir kids walking by. You know, you're going to get people coming in with a variety of mental health difficulties. So being able to think that through and respond to it's really important. And I would say it's probably actually one of your key evangelistic strategies. You know, you might have a CAP money course that you run, and you get all kinds of people who've got financial difficulties, and they come into the church as a result. Wouldn't it be amazing if there was an ability for people to know that this is a church which is mentally safe, competent? We're not talking about being amateur therapists, but we're talking about a safe place to come. It's a really relevant and pertinent way to grow the church in the 21st century. Okay, on the next slide, what do we find about mental health in the Bible? Because obviously if you go looking in the Bible, you don't find the term psychiatrist. Okay, I think we get physician. It's about as close as we get. But we don't find the term psychiatrist. And it's quite hard to sort of link these things together. So this is a picture, William Blake's painting of Nebuchadnezzar. It's in the Tate Gallery in London, and you may know the verses from Daniel chapter 4. By the way, I've got a PDF of these slides plus the notes I'm reading from, and so all the Bible verses, all the pictures, they can be emailed around afterwards. So I'm going to send that on to Lisa, and she can send that on with the comms email afterwards. So don't feel you have to frantically scribble. Daniel chapter 4, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man and let him be given the mind of an animal till seven times or 7 years pass by for him. So I'm in the Old Testament. Now, I'm not quite sure whether that is the curse of God or psychosis or something, but something is happening. It's one of the clearest descriptions, perhaps, in the Bible of today, what we might recognize as schizophrenia, if we had to make an equivalence. But something was happening. Something was going on there. So there definitely was a thing. And then, you know, emotions are also part of the Bible as well. The Shema, the God's command to the Israelites. You know, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength from Deuteronomy 6. It's a command to love. It's not a feeling. Love is an activity, an action, these emotions. And, you know, we sometimes say that one of the problems with us is that we have the mind up here. The Jews had the heart down here. For them, it was very integrated into their faith and culture to have these kinds of emotions. Or if you look at the emotions of Jesus, you've got joy, exhaustion, anger, disgust, sorrow, compassion, frustration, agony, empathy, forgiveness. So when God says, break my heart for what breaks yours, as the song said, that's what he's talking about. This is going to get into some difficult, we need to talk about emotions. I sometimes have spoken in Anglican churches, and if you go to an Anglican church, you say, emotions? What are they? You know, do we do emotions here? We're Anglican, you know. And you can do that in any kind of denomination, really. I'm going to talk about suicide later on in this talk. Okay, so we need to sort of be touching on some of these topics, because if we don't, we haven't thought them through. Okay, there's one of the other things I want to sort of introduce to you, perhaps, is we often talk about, you know, the vertical relationship with God and our horizontal relationship with each other. So if you've just got the next slide there, let's just pull that through a little bit. We know that we've got a relationship with God which became cut off because of the fall and our sin. And that's restored, so we can now become heirs. But let's think about some of these sort of, I've got five horizontal relationships here. The first, perhaps, is how we are with our close friends. You know, we have Eve as the helper, the friend. And then the result of that is shame and having to wear fig leaves. But the restoration of that in the church body and ultimately in heaven is love. We have a body which becomes mortal. We are going to die after our 70 years. And actually, there's two things there. Yes, eternal life and a resurrection body, but also doctors. So I think doctors are part of the ways in which God's general revelation blesses us today. And he has given skill to, I remember talking to Francis Crick, who was the guy who sort of coded the Human Genome Project. And he was a super duper geneticist, but he was also a passionate Christian. And he saw those two things very closely together. I know there's a couple of sort of doctors or mental health professionals in the audience today. That is God's, you being part of God's healing in that sort of horizontal way alongside the vertical healing. Work, you know, Adam had this role to name the animals. It became a chore where he couldn't find, you know, he had to till the ground and it was hard work. And then it's restored again and we can put our hands up and say, thank God it's Monday. Everyone else says, thank God it's Friday. We can say, thank God it's Monday. I'm going to my job that is my, I'm going to spend 40, 50 hours a week for 40 years of my life doing this. This is part of my ministry. So God restores work. Nature, I'm going to get all green and eco here for a second. We polluted it. When God so loved the world, that meant that God hugged trees, literally. You know, it's literally, he loves this world. We need to be ecologically aware as Christians and not view that as some sort of left-wing fad. It's all part of this restoring of our horizontal relationships. And the last one there, we had our mind. We had a mind, a healthy mind. We knew who we were. We had our identity sorted in the Garden of Eden. And as a result of that, we became distressed, confused, depressed, maybe even insane. And part of the restoration of that is peace. Is that different to doctor, or is it more counseling, or is it more community? There's a whole bunch of things around that. But I guess what I want to try and suggest to you is that as we think about this vertical relationship, actually our horizontal relationships are so multifaceted that we need to think about how our brain fits into that and how that will work its way through. And what does peace mean? Is that healing from mental illness? Is it medical treatment? Is it community? Is it et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Now, one of the problems when I start talking about this, and if you just pop the next slide up there, is that we've all got our favorite thing. And you probably heard this said, that if all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So you go around and bang the hammer. But what if it's a screw? Actually, what you need there is a screwdriver. What if it's a bent nail? What you need is one of those funny, curvy plier things. I'm not quite sure what they're called, to pull the nail out. You know, there are different tools for different things. And one of the problems, I think, is that we all get passionate about our particular thing. So what have we got on here? Bottom left, we've got brain cells. Okay, I have no idea if brain cells look like that. Probably not. Personally, I hope my brain is a little bit more densely packed with brain cells than that one. That one seems to be suffering some BSE or something like that. We know loads about genetics, chemical imbalances, and particularly when you see things like dementia or schizophrenia, you can perhaps sort of see what's going on with things like anxiety, depression, eating disorder, self-esteem. It is more difficult, but we do know quite a lot about the brain. We know quite a lot about the genetics of alcohol addiction. Okay, it's not just learned behavior or opportunity. So we've got a lot of biology that we know, and some people will push that, as that's their thing, that's what they know about. Some people, the second one there, the picture top right, the person all by themselves, they will say that all mental distress results from social isolation. And they're kind of right. And sometimes I think I could not do half my job if there was decent community. I remember working in central Bradford for a while, and you know, you get this like single white guy would come in with a presentation of schizophrenia, and I thought, oh my word, where is the community against this person? He's estranged from his parents. Where's everything else going on? And then my next patient, I get half the Pakistani community of central Bradford would try and come into the office at the same time. And, you know, it was kind of slightly crazy, and we had to work out how that worked. But I thought, this person has support. This person has that strong community around them. So let's make sure that we're addressing that as well. The Bible there. The spiritual thing. Is this all a spiritual thing? You know, is it, everything's the result of the fall. So surely everything should be fixed by a spiritual solution, by prayer or perhaps even deliverance, you know, deliverance ministry. And, you know, so I think some people will take a very spiritual approach to things. And then lastly, that's a picture of Carl Rogers there, the founder of person-centered therapy, that actually it's really just a matter of each person needs that space where they can receive unconditional positive regard. They just need that space to be allowed to be themselves, and the answer is within themselves to some degree. And that's not necessarily anti-Christian. You know, we believe in a revealed faith from on high, don't we? But I think when you give people space, they can often find their own answers. And when they find their own answers, it's often more powerful than them being told the answer. So, you know, we can bring faith into all of these things. We can bring faith into our medication as well. You know, all of these things fit together. So I think that the danger is that we sort of want to sort of attack everything with our favorite thing. So I've got a little task for you. If you could pop the next slide, please. So what I want you to do, it's just a 5-minute task, low key. Inside your envelopes, you've got £1,000 of Monopoly money, okay? And what I want you to do is I want you to pick, and we'll perhaps put the previous slide up in a second. Imagine that's your table with the four squares on it. So you've got a biological corner, a spiritual corner, a psychological corner, and a social corner. And what I want you to do is allocate that £1,000 according to what you think, and this is the important bit, in our society, what's the main cause of mental distress today? Do you think it's social? Do you think it's psychological? Do you think it's spiritual? Or do you think it's biological? It's a little bit of fun. Take your £1,000. What I suggest you do is one person lays it out and then you can argue. Okay? So off you go. 5 minutes. So a bit like in Sunday school, the right answer is Jesus. The right answer here is £250 in each quarter. No, I'm joking. And I think, you know, again, there's no right or wrong answers to these things. So, for example, you may say, well, actually, we're going to put the money on the other things because the spiritual bit is taken care of. What we perhaps need to do, though, is not think of the sort of spiritual bit as somehow happening by Holy Spirit magic. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you're really struggling with something, if you go forward and receive prayer and you're healed, brilliant, great, it just kind of happens. But what if you're then struggling with the similar thing later on in your life? Or what if you're wanting to share with someone else who perhaps going through something different and all you've got is it just happened? You know, so I think there's understanding our healing rather than having that black box, I think, is part of it. And some of it might be God is just doing things behind the scenes and we don't understand what is going on and it's a miraculous healing. Other times, I think we might understand the social, the psycho, the biological, or even the spiritual, you know, discipleship, perhaps to use a word. You know, we have put a lot of emphasis on being saved, which is great, but actually there's tons about discipleship and ongoing spiritual growth and maturity. So I think really understanding spiritual change and understanding how Holy Spirit would work, I think is really important as well, rather than saying, that's spiritual, don't know what's going on there, thank you, Jesus. You know, we can actually share. And there's an excellent course, which my wife's actually doing this year, run by Christian Connections, quite a lot of links with St. Mungo's Church. But they've trained a lot of the Christian counselors, and they really are encouraging you to have that sort of mind and soul together, if that makes sense. You're really thinking this through. Okay, so thanks for that. I'm going to talk a wee bit more, and then we'll have some sort of more Q&As and have a look at the sort of stuff that's coming through the Slido. So please get your phones out and do Slido app, those of you who know what Slido is. If you don't, you can just write it down on a bit of paper and give it to Luke. That's also fine. So I want to talk a little bit about the history of all of this, if we can just pop the next slide up there. If you don't like history, sorry, okay, but it's actually really important just to spend a little bit of time thinking about this, because I think if we don't learn our history, we're condemned to repeat its mistakes, aren't we? So where did we start out with all of this? Now, I actually want to take you right back to New Testament times, where a couple of things were happening. First of all, we had that sort of very integrated view of the Jewish heart that was coming through. And I'm not saying that the Old Testament describes this perfectly, but it was just a thing. You know, when Nebuchadnezzar came back from his madness, there was no stigma like we might give to someone who perhaps had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. He just was mad, and then he came back. And it kind of almost seemed to work better. And then when we get to the New Testament, Christianity is trying to sort of find itself, think itself through. And one of the things that happened was Greek influences coming into the church. And if you look at one of the big debates in the New Testament, it's about this thing called Gnosticism. And if you want to learn more about that, go and ask the clever full-time elders who work here. They'll tell you lots about Gnosticism. But basically, it's this sort of, there's something more, or there's something special over there, or Platonic dualism, if you want to get a bit into the philosophy. And they began to bring in this separation between mind and soul. And from that, we had these ideas that can be quite strong in Christianity, that we on here are sinners, and it's all fixed there. Or another consequence of this is that sex is somehow sort of dirty, and actually it's you know, it's the spiritual life which is to be talked about. And this split between the physical and the spiritual is something that actually has its roots there in those sort of Greek influences coming in. And actually, I think constantly the Bible actually is calling us to be more holistic. But that's when it kind of started, this sort of spiritual stuff happens over here, earthly stuff happens over here. And it began to follow its way through. We then had the Dark Ages, and it all got a bit messy with King Arthur and all that sort of stuff. And then we began to sort of come out after that. And we began to see the first psychiatric hospitals appearing. So the first psychiatric hospital in the UK was the Bethlehem Hospital in London, which is now used to be called Bedlam. That was the old name for it. And that's where the phrase Bedlam comes from. So the Bethlehem and Maudsley from 1247, opened by an order of nuns. So I think somebody was saying, you know, who did mental health care before 200 years ago? Answer is, the church did it. And they're right, actually. So the Bethlehem Hospital was there. It was beaten by a hospital founded by the Muslims in Baghdad in the 9th century. So sorry, we couldn't quite do the very first psychiatric hospital. But certainly the first one in the West was opened by nuns in London. And from that time on, the church began to do a whole bunch of these sort of ministries and outreaches and a whole bunch of things. And a lot of this was done through monasteries. A lot of this was done through sort of local religious communities. They would do a whole bunch of things. There'd be places of healing. There'd be places of education and learning. And then what happened in around about 1536 is Henry VIII was on the throne, and there was this debate and arguments with whether or not we were going to be part of the Catholic Church or not. And there's not a whole story we could tell about that. But The relevant thing here is that one of the things that Henry VIII did was to basically sack the monasteries, to destroy a lot of the monasteries. And if you go looking around the country, a lot of the ruins of monasteries that you see date from that time when these buildings were destroyed. And there's a few things that happened. The first was that the center of learning was destroyed, and there was a real damage to the local community. But the other thing that happened is basically half the hospitals were destroyed. So imagine if all of our hospitals were suddenly sort of wiped out. And it was a great time when the church, a lot of the church's involvement in healing and that sort of thing took a major hit at that point. Go a bit further forward in history, another 100 years or so, you had René Descartes. And again, those of you who are into philosophy will know about the sort of mind-body distinction that he spoke about. I'd actually encourage you to sort of maybe look into that and read it. I think Descartes is sort of misquoted. I don't think he was actually advocating a mind-body distinction. I think that was people jumping on it with this sort of Platonic dualism, this sort of Gnostic view that I was talking about from the early days. So he actually wasn't saying that. He was a passionate Catholic believer, you know, born again, I believe. But people took that and said, there's a distinction between mind and body. These things are different. And then the picture here, why have I put the picture here? The reason I put the picture here is this is one of the most significant things in the development of mental health care. This is a play by Alan Bennett called The Madness of King George. And you've got Nigel Hawthorne there. King George III basically goes completely mad. They decided to call it The Madness of King George. The initial title for the film was King George III. They didn't call it that because the American audiences said, what happened to King George and King George II? But that apparently is true. So they didn't call it King George III. They called it The Madness of King George. And the royal family, due to the fact that they didn't marry particularly widely, suffered, you've probably heard of the haemophilia stuff in the royal family. Well, one of the other things that was going on in the royal families of Europe was this thing called porphyria, which is a liver metabolism disorder. It's basically where there's an enzyme in the liver is not present or not working, and you accumulate these sort of toxic metabolites. And acute porphyria, which is what he had, is where you have these episodes of psychosis. And it's a really interesting thing to think about in light of the task we've just done, because it's an extremely biological thing. We know what it is. We can run a lab test for it nowadays. We can, in the old days, you used to have to put the urine on the windowsill and see if it turned dark. But we can test for this. We can diagnose it. We can treat it to a certain extent, some of the porphyria. So it's a very, very biological thing. The problem is, it happened to the king. So if you imagine at that point that a lot of mental illness was effectively seen as spiritual distress, and it was spiritual solutions to it because the church were still involved, you've got the interesting thing here. Who is going to heal the king? Which priest are we going to get in to pray for the king? And if I don't know how much you know about the Anglican Church, but by that point, the king was the head of the Anglican Church. So it's a bit like trying to cast a demon out of your boss. Right? It's not good for career progression. So we have this really interesting thing where suddenly, right, we thought the Lord's anointed, the king, is obviously spiritually ill. What's going to happen to this? And these three doctors are in the film. It's a comedy film. And one of the doctors is obsessed with the pulse, and he wants the pulse taken 17 times a day. One of the doctors is obsessed with the stool, and he wants to know if it floats and a number of other unmentionable things. And the guy who actually gets him well, and this is where it gets really interesting, he's a priest who uses behavioral therapy to treat a biological illness. So basically, he takes the king off to this house in the country and trains him to be less mad. And you might think, how can you use behavioral therapy to treat psychosis? Well, actually, that was how it was treated until 70 years ago when antipsychotic medications were invented. And it's surprisingly effective. We may think, if you're psychotic, you must take a dopamine blocker. But actually, you know, it's not ineffective. So what we've got in this picture is we've got this intermingling between this sort of, because of the mind-body divide, we've got this mental illness which must be seen as spiritual. But you can't use a spiritual solution because it's your boss. So what we're going to do, we're going to sort of find a sort of face-saving way where he kind of goes over here to this cottage in the country, has some behavioral therapy, and then finally comes back as king. And what you've got going on around it is Pitt the Younger and Pitt the Older and a whole bunch of stuff going on in the social environment where actually how mental illness was seen in society was radically changing. Because reasonably soon after that, you got William Shaftesbury coming in with the first modern Mental Health Act. So we've got a Mental Health Act in this country. To have a Mental Health Act is one of the requirements to join the EU. Did you know that? So a lot of the Baltic states who are recently joining the EU, one of the things they had to do was go away and write a Mental Health Act to ensure the humane treatment of people with mental illness rather than being left in prison or incarcerated without limit. And Shaftesbury was absolutely instrumental with that. Now, you might think of Shaftesbury for his work on ending slavery. You might think of Shaftesbury for his work with the Poor Act and some of the other things. But if you go to Piccadilly Circus in London, we've all seen the statue of Eros, haven't we, in Piccadilly Circus in London. It's not Eros, okay? It's Anteros, his twin brother in Greek mythology. And if you go into the church that's on the corner, there's a plaque, you can read about it. It's Anteros, because Eros was the Greek of selfish love. Anteros was the Greek of selfless love and self-giving. So it's a statue of Anteros. And on this plaque, on the side of Piccadilly Circus, it says, from William Gladstone, MP, to my friend Lord Shaftesbury, for his work among the poor and the insane. That's what the plaque on the side of Piccadilly Circus says. So next time you're in London, go and have a look. Test me out on this. And we had the first Lunacy Act, it was called. They didn't have very nice terms for ill people in those days. They were lunatics or enfeebles or something like that. And it suggested for the first time that you might actually be released in hospital someday. It suggested that the owners of the hospital were not paid per capita, because that just encourages the collection of people in hospital. So it was radical. And there's been a number of versions of the Mental Health Act. And actually Scotland, I would say, has got one of the best and most empowering bits of mental health legislation in the world, which actually is now going through a further review because they really want to lead the world in that social change. So that was 1845. 1860, the first BSc was awarded, Bachelor of Science. Hands up in the room, just out of interest, who's got a BSc or something like a Bachelor of Science degree? Who's got a BA? Okay, about half and half, all right? I have a BA in neuroscience. That's a bit weird. How did I get a BA in neuroscience? The answer is I went to an extremely ancient university that ever since 1200 and something has only been handing out two degrees, BAs and BDs. I actually have an MA from the same university by living for 3 years after my BA. That's another weird story. So I have a Bachelor of Arts degree because Cambridge, the university I went to, does not hand out BSCs. Just doesn't. So you can be doing like, you know, engineering science or something like that, and you still get a BA. And it's a really weird setup. But most universities have got this split between arts and science. And again, it comes back to this dualism, this split between the spiritual and the scientific. So theology is in the arts bit of the campus. Medicine is in the science bit of the campus. These things are split out. Never the twain shall meet. Now, the question is, where does that leave psychology? Where does that leave the Department of Psychology? And the answer is, in some universities, you get a BA in psychology because it's psychology and counseling, and that's in the arts side of it. In some universities, you get a BSc because it's experimental psychology, and that's in the science bit. So psychology lands us right in the middle of the exercise that you've just done, because it can see the social, it can see the biological, because they talk to the psychiatrists. You can see the spiritual, because they understand, because they're in the same bit as divinity. And the word university means to learn together. The first university in Alexandria, the one that was burnt, had burnt the library, didn't they, when they sacked Alexandria fairly soon after Jesus' time. The first university was about being together in our study. And what we've done is in our modern universities, we've brought diversity. We've divided out, okay? The quintessence, the quintessential joining together, the fifth essence, the thing that joins all of this together is our faith in God. And that's how universities were found. And what we've done is we've split off arts and science. And it's one of the reasons why we've got into the sort of pickle where we are today. So, 1955, let's land this in the sort of slightly more modern era. A guy called O was his first initial. O. Herbert Maurer was the president of the American Psychological Association, like the leading psychologist in America. And he said this. He said, for several decades, we psychologists have looked on the whole matter of sin and moral accountability and all that sort of stuff as a great incubus, a great bit of fluff, basically, as far as they're saying. And we've acclaimed our liberation from it as epoch-making. So psychology has said, oh, now we can study it, we can measure it, we can do rating scales. We don't need to think about morality and sin anymore. We are free, we are open-minded, we are scientific, it's the great enlightenment. All of these things are going. But, he said, at length we have discovered that to be free in this sense, that is, to have the excuse of being sick rather than being sinful, is to also court the danger of being lost. Let's read that last bit again. We've discovered that to be free in this sense, i.e. to be sick rather than sinful, is also to court the danger of being lost. And what he's saying was, don't get me wrong, actually, the medicalization of depression and anxiety was hugely important because you were no longer weak or stupid or idiotic. You had a medical condition. There were treatments available, antidepressants, cognitive behavioral therapy. It's been helpful to a large degree to medicalize mental health conditions. But if we do so at the expense of thinking about morality and thinking about the other side of the coin, we end up looking for these solutions when actually we haven't addressed it. And that's why this book I mentioned with the biblical model of the mind, where the heart is inside the body or the soul is inside the brain, is really important because our brain chemistry does affect our faith, but actually it's our faith that is at the root and at the heart and can push out through that. So it's really important that we sort of don't pick our particular quadrant and go for it. We either will over-sin it and take people away from treatments that work for them, or we'll over-treatment it and actually forget the heart of the gospel, which is we are sinners in need of a savior who are then restored as heirs, given a role, etc. Those six things that I mentioned earlier. It's a bit of a sort of, you just got to sort of take your head and just think, right, okay, it's not complex because it's actually really simple. And the really simple bit is, don't make it too simple. Remember, it's complex. If you can remember that, then I think we're quite a long way forward. Okay, end of history lesson. Where do we land today? On the next slide there. We land today in a situation where if you look at the top 10 TED Talks of all time, you'll find these people, all right? You've got Ruby Wax. What's so funny about mental illness? It's a hoot. It really is. Very, very funny. You've got Brené Brown, we might talk about earlier, about the power of vulnerability. And yes, we did blatantly steal that when we talked about the power of belonging. And we quote Brené Brown quite a lot. But it's really good stuff. It's talking about the importance of vulnerability in ourselves and leadership and our maturity. You've got Sir Ken Davidson, top TED Talk of all time, talking about how schools kill creativity. And I think as a result, perhaps cause a whole bunch of sort of distress amongst our teenagers as well. And we've got all those statistics that we've got going on, you know, where one in four will have some kind of mental health problem. And we're not immune in the church. Now, I'm going to guess there's 150 people here today. That means that between one and two of you at some point in your life will have a psychotic illness and be admitted to hospital. Okay? I'm going to guess that a quarter of this room are taking an antidepressant of some kind, a tenth of this room self-harm. Okay? Those are the stats in society. And I know the church is not immune. So that may not be this particular room, but we need to be thinking about this because it is so important. Right, let's bring some of this into land a little bit. I'm just going to talk about a couple of topics before we get to the end. One is about medication, and the second topic is about suicide. If we look at medication, one of the things that Christians sometimes think is, I ought to be able to fix this spiritually. Or, if I can't fix it spiritually, then I'll see a Christian counsellor. Okay, and that's kind of acceptable. But I want to talk a bit about medication, because I know that people in this room take psychiatric medication, and maybe they're not open about it. Okay, one of the reasons they're not open about it is because they may think people would say, why do you need that for? And hopefully they wouldn't be quite so aggressive as that in this setting, because you lot are far more enlightened than that. But they might be thinking, maybe they're not quite as strong as the rest of us, you know, or something like that. So one of the things, people sometimes say things like, it acts on my brain, and I want to keep my brain pure, that's just for Jesus. And I don't want anything that acts on my brain. They may say, it's strong. So if you take antipsychotic medication, you'll probably have side effects. Okay, we don't want to take stuff that's too strong. There must be a different way. Or that they have side effects, like I've said already. Or this is a spiritual problem, something that we see as spiritual and must have a spiritual solution. So just on the next slide, I've just popped up a few sort of replies to that. Did you know that paracetamol acts on the brain? Okay, so I'm going to guess that everybody in this room has taken paracetamol at some point. I did ask this once, and someone said, no, they've never taken a painkiller. My reply was, good luck. but you know, we've probably all taken paracetamol. Now, paracetamol does not act on your big toe when you stub it. It acts deep in the hindbrain here on the processing of the pain signal in the brain, okay? It acts on the brain. It's strong. So is morphine, okay? Who here has had, I won't ask you to put your hands up, but any of the fairer sex among us who have been through childbirth, I imagine have had some strong painkillers. And it's like, yes, I want the, what's it called, the thing where they put it in your spine? Give me that. That would be great, thank you. You know, we don't mind strong medication when it's for the right thing. That shouldn't be our reason to say no. It has side effects. Chemotherapy has side effects. What we're doing is we're treating a life-threatening illness with cancer. And when I meet people who have their first psychotic episode, one of the things I say to them is that we need to take this as seriously as if you had cancer. Because if we don't treat this right, you'll be in and out of hospitals the rest of your life. Okay? I need you to take this medication. I'll work with you to find the right one with the least side effects, but I need you to take this. I need you to take it for the next 2 years, at least. Don't stop it the moment you get better. Because my goal is for actually you to have the best outcome. If you stop it after 6 weeks because the voices have gone, you'll be back in hospital. And you actually, every time you go back into hospital, it sort of stretches and stresses your brain and it becomes more and more of a problem. So I lay it on thick and say, this is like a cancer diagnosis. We need to take it as seriously. We need to get your family involved. We need to be doing some future planning, okay? It's a spiritual problem. Talk about Jesus' exorcisms for a second. Jesus, the most common groups in the New Testament where Jesus did an exorcism was, first of all, the church leaders at the time, the Pharisees, okay? And the second group were people who seemed to have something that today we would call epilepsy. And I've never heard any Christian be afraid to say they take anti-epileptic medication. So why is it we're afraid to say that we take antidepressants or antipsychotic medication or something else, okay? Okay, let's talk about suicide. On the next slide, these are the 7 times in the Bible where someone seems to take their own life. Okay, so some of them you'll know. Samson, who brought the temple down on top of himself. Okay, Judas, the famous one. These 7 times, the point I want to make is that they just are in the Bible, generally speaking. They're not given a moral interpretation quite a lot of the time. So if we go on to the next slide and just talk through them in a bit more detail. Okay, so Abimelech, gives you an idea of the time, he was in Judges, and Judges was not a good time in church history, let's face it. Okay, so he basically would rather kill himself than be killed by a woman. That was his thing. And, you know, the Bible states that. It doesn't actually give us a spiritual commentary on it. Samson died for a cause he believed in, but he also did it for revenge. Let's be honest. Okay, that's the other reason. If you read Samson, that's the other reason he did that. Saul, David's predecessor, he was in a corner, couldn't live up to his own expectations, felt rejected, felt a failure. Perhaps similar to some of the thinkings that goes on when someone tries to take their own life today. But there's not a commentary made on it as such. Saul's armor bearer just did it as his boss did it. And, you know, he thought, right, if Saul's gone, I'm going to go as well. And he fell on his sword. That one I can't pronounce. Okay. So this actually is really interesting. This one and the other one, you probably won't have heard of. The first one, it says he was died and buried in his father's tomb. The second one, it says, died because of the sins he was committed. And the reason I've put those two up there is that one of them is clearly he died. There was some kind of divine process here, and there was sin at the heart of it. The other one, he's died and buried in his father's tomb. There's no commentary at all. And the reason why I've put that up, perhaps, is just to remind us that when we think of this kind of topic, we often sort of blame or point or think, could I have done more or something like that. The Bible actually is reasonably mixed on the topic at best. Okay, and then Judas, the famous one, but, you know, someone had to be in that role. Someone had to betray the Messiah. And actually Judas was someone who had, I think, at least regret, even if not full reconciliation. So I don't know where Judas is now, but there we are. Okay, next slide. Why suicide causes so much problems? You know, it was a mortal sin until 1997 in the Catholic Church. And one of the history of this is really, really interesting. It started in the 4th century. And what happened in the 2nd and 3rd century is people were martyrs, you know, killed by Nero, burnt alive. You've read about the sort of history of the church fathers and the martyrs and what was going on. And what happened in the 4th century was people were starting to go beyond that. They were almost starting to sort of march into the middle of meetings with the opposition and almost try and get themselves killed. Okay, they were sort of thinking the martyr's a bit like we sometimes hear about, you know, the suicide bombers today, that, you know, a martyr's death is a glorious death. And what was happening in the 4th century was that they were almost sort of putting themselves in situations where they would be killed or taking their own life in very sort of public ways. And the church fathers actually had to come out and say, stop it. Suicide, taking your own life, is not of God. And the reason they were saying that was to address this particular issue around cheap martyrdom. But again, the consequences of that, and it all comes back to our mind-body divide and everything else, the consequences were that it was illegal to kill yourself in the suicide in the UK until 1961. Not quite sure what the punishment was, because you were not there to receive it, but you were not able to receive insurance payouts if you killed yourself. You've probably seen it in films, you know, people have insured the wife, and then they go and kill themselves. But they try and make it look like an accident, because if it's found out to be suicide, there wouldn't be any payout until relatively recently. It was a mortal sin until 1977. And if you're wondering what that block of text is, it's from the Catholic Catechism. And this was updated. That second paragraph was added, or this section was added in 1997. I'll just read the last bit out. Grave psychological disturbances, anguish, or grave fear of hardship, suffering, or torture can diminish the responsibility of the one committing suicide. So 1997 was the first time that the Catholic Church publicly acknowledged that mental illness was a factor in suicide. So date it from the 4th century through until 1997. And it was seen as a sort of mortal sin. Until that point, it's still something which has huge stigma around it. And it does leave, what I mean by a special scar, is it leaves us asking questions. It leaves us asking things like, could I have done more? Should I have spotted this? Whereas when I think we see someone die of cancer, we don't have those thoughts by and large. We sometimes think, could I have visited more often? But we don't think, could I have somehow prevented this cancer? We kind of understand that. It all comes back to this mind-body divide. We think, oh, can't see it, therefore it must be in the spiritual realm, therefore we need to try harder or whatever, or psychological realm. People ought to have been able to fix it. And that's not always the case. So how can we do better? How can we do a bit better in this? So I've almost finished. The next picture here is just, this is of the Chook, the retreat in York, and a little picture there. They all look the same, don't they, from the 1800s. William Chook. Was this guy, and he was a Quaker, he was an abolitionist, okay, for slavery, he was patron of the Bible Society. And a friend of his, Hannah Mills, died in the York Asylum, mistreated, prevented from having visitors, you know, pretty horrendous situations in the York Asylum. Did you know the Royal Edinburgh Hospital was founded for similar reasons? So if you go down to the Royal Mile and go down to Canongate Kirk, which is halfway down, outside you'll see a statue of a wee boy running. He was a friend of Robbie Burns, okay? And he became ill. This is not on the plaque there, okay? This is, you have to dig a bit into the history to find this. He became ill and psychotic and was taken into the Edinburgh Asylum. And something similar happened to him. He died in awful conditions. So Burns and a few others got together and raised some money. A bit of controversy around this because some of the money came from the Highland clearances. But they got the money together and they built Mackinnon House, which is the first sandstone block in the Royal Edinburgh Hospital, that big building you see when you go in there. So it was the Royal Ed actually was started for similar reasons. There must be a better way to do this in the asylums. What Tuke did was he built a thing called the Retreat. And interestingly enough, he particularly always brought together physical health and mental health. He always brought these two things together, and he wanted to sort of have corridors, people could spend time. The wards were open, for want of a better description. People could spend time in communal spaces. They had baths and spas, is the best way I can think about it. These sort of physical, relaxing, encouraging treatments. They had diet, they had exercise. And he also brought this idea of humane and moral treatment. It wasn't moral in the sort of pure spiritual kind of sense, but it was dignified, self-esteem, spirituality and responsibility. So the retreat at York was one of these early sort of reintegrated hospitals, for want of a better description. And they actually stopped doing inpatient care in 2018, after 222 years. So if you want to sort of find a slightly more integrated way of running a hospital, I'm not suggesting that King's Church go and start a hospital. Although you've got quite a lot of space in this building, I keep being told. So You could go and sort of start a hospital, but I think it's just an example of reintegrating, bringing those things back together. And the retreat lives on the next slide. Like I say, nowadays it's an outpatient specialist center for eating disorders, and it leaves the church like we started out at the beginning, where we're looking. People are looking at the local church; they're not looking at the higher power. So, the church, I think, has to be a place where people can come without stigma to talk about these things. We don't want to jump on the popularist bandwagon and be amateur psychologists and watch TED Talks and try and do stuff that way. But likewise, we don't want to over-spiritualize it. We don't want to sort of keep that mind-body divide going on. And just the last slide there. Each generation of the church has its divisions. The New Testament, I spoke about with the sort of Gnostics and the pure faith, but also what was going on in the New Testament. Don't forget that Gentile Jew division. And Paul said Christ came to break down the dividing wall of hostility and literally tear the curtain down between Jew and Gentile. That was what was the big focus in the New Testament. A little bit later on, we had that slave and free, touched on a bit in the New Testament, and I think that was one of the key drivers behind emancipation and the freedom of slavery, abolition, and the freedom of slavery, that division between slave and free, between black and white. Why do we have black churches and white churches by and large? You know, I think that's one of the challenges for our time. Between rich and poor, we have churches in affluent areas, we have churches in less affluent areas. And I think we need to be challenging constantly these boundaries. And the final thought I want to leave you with today is there a division in this church between sane and insane? We sort of think, oh, that person has a problem. I am fine. I have no mental health problems. I don't need that. I don't need medication. I don't need counseling. I don't need whatever it is yet, I would say. We have that division between sane and insane. We somehow think less of people. And this is Carl Jung, Freud's mate. And Carl Jung had this great quote I would just leave you with. Carl Jung said, "Show me a sane man and I will cure him for you." I will cure him for you. So perhaps today is a little bit of a cure, a bit of a challenge, a bit of a sort of random tour through history. Sorry for any of you who fell asleep. But on that note, I will stop, and Luke's going to master our questions and see how that goes. So thank you very much.
Let's try it. Thanks, Rob. So I'm going to ask, I'm just going to bring a couple of the questions together that kind of relate to each other. So you've really worked in this session on getting us to have a much more integrated view of mental health causes and, I guess, expressions as well. It express itself spiritually and socially and all those kind of things. So I guess I wanted to explore that in a couple of ways. One is, and this might be more likely to happen within a church context, if mental health conditions are a combination of the different quadrants, how do you engage with people who think that one quadrant is the cause? So this might be, for example, a Christian who's like, this has to be spiritual, there can be no other explanation for it, or perhaps somebody who's come from either just a more scientific background or that's their family situation or something like that, who's like, this is purely, you know, an issue of the chemicals in my brain. So that is one part of the question. Then the other part of the question, do we then as leaders, do we just need to be aware that there are four potential things going on, or is there more that we can do?
Yeah, so I think the first answer to that is have an event like this. And that's why it's so important that we're kind of discussing this in the open. And if you want to take it slightly further, you might want to do Healthcare Sunday in October. You might want to do a Mental Health Sunday for the whole church, just everybody. And it can be fairly low key. It doesn't have to be heavy, if that makes sense. And we've got some resources on the Mind and Soul Foundation website for a sort of Mental Health Sunday. So I think what you're doing is you're mainstreaming it. You're putting it out there. Christians Against Poverty, many of you will be aware of their charity. All their staff members, every single year at their annual appraisal, they're asked two questions. First of all, how many duvet days have you had this year? Okay, and the second thing is there anything we can be doing to support your mental health? And they're two really simple questions, but what they're doing is they're putting it on the agenda rather than the person having to put their hand up and say, I'm really struggling. So you're mainstreaming it. So I think that's one of the things. I think if someone has got, and I think probably this book would be a good one to have a look at in terms of the biblical model of the mind about how this fits together, and hopefully just be aware. And of course, the third thing is, it's not either or. You don't have to put all your £1,000 on one quadrant. It's perfectly possible to be actively pursuing a spiritual solution and a social solution and a medical solution and whatever the last one is, psychological solution. So all of these things can come together, and I would argue probably should come together. So, there's a verse in, I think, Ephesians. It's, take all of these things that you have learnt from me and put them into practice, and the peace of God will be with you. So it's like elementary CBT from St. Paul. We've got to practice these things. We've got to work these things through. So you can do it all. You don't need to have your favourite.
Okay. And so then for leaders, you think that, therefore, events like this and reading those books and learning those kind of things, I imagine some leaders will tend more to the personal, some leaders will tend more to the teaching, some leaders will tend more to the prophetic or the deliverance or whatever. Is that legit? How do you make sure that you maintain, I don't like the word balance, but how do you make sure that you're doing all the things?
I think it's fine to do what you're skilled at and what you're gifted at. I think it's about being aware that other things. So Jesus was always very clear to say, even when someone's healed, go and talk to the rabbi. Get sign off, if that makes sense. So I think, if we are doing healing ministry or prophecy or something like that, what we shouldn't be doing is diminishing the other stuff that's going on. We'll talk a bit about sort of pastoral care structures later, but I think we probably need to be talking to someone else in the church maybe, and also saying, if you're taking medication, keep taking it. The last thing you want to do is think that you're healed, stop taking medication, and for the wheels to fall off. God is a gracious and generous God, and if he has genuinely supernaturally healed you, he will understand that you want to keep taking medication for a while and then slowly under medical supervision wean yourself off it. And it's trying to sort of be just wise and adult about these things rather than saying, my way's the only way, all I've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, it must conform, because it's just not true. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. I think that's, so you might ask, you might address this a little bit later on, but I guess I was wondering about this as, charismatic churches in particular, as we are, and you experience that and believe God for that. Obviously, our immediate response is to pray and for hope for the immediate thing. And we find it generally much harder to do the patient thing, the long-term thing. Have you got any advice on correcting that without, because you know the thing of like, Lord, we pray that you heal this person right now, but Lord, if that's not your will, that's fine. And we kind of feel like that's not satisfying.
Yeah.
But what might be?
I think, I wonder if it comes back to what I was saying about, you know, the black box of healing. I mean, personally, I believe that, you know, when God does heal, he heals deeply. You know, in a way, he's not there to sort of confuse us. We are meant to bow down before him. But I think he understands that. And I think he will, you know, even if you are healed, let's say, of depression, for example, there will still be other stuff to sort out. There will still be habits that will need unwinding. There will still be generational ties or family of origin issues that you may need to be counseled and perhaps have ongoing prayer ministry or talk through with a skilled counselor. You may come to the understanding that your brain works better when you take a small dose of antidepressants, even though you've been healed. And that's okay, because it's okay to take medication. It doesn't mean you're less of a Christian. So Jeff Lucas, many of you know, he writes the sort of end column in Christianity magazine. He takes antidepressants. Quite open about that. You know? So why not? And I think it doesn't mean that you don't have full faith just because you're taking something which acts on your brain, in the same way that you can take an anti-epileptic medication or a blood pressure medication as well.
Is it, do you think, the dramatic nature of exorcism, particularly in the New Testament, that then really supercharges those kind of mind and soul distinctions, body and soul distinctions, and makes us, because I remember someone saying to someone else who was experiencing, I think it was depression, and they were frustrated that they couldn't do this kind of thing. Mm. And that the other person said, if you'd broken your leg, you wouldn't be trying to walk on it. Mm-hmm. And we would say that to anyone with a broken leg. We would never say to someone, but you should be walking on it. Mm. But we don't do that with mental health issues. And do you feel like there's an added Christian complication because of what we see Jesus doing in the New Testament?
I'll talk about the pigs later.
Mm, great.
the 2000
It's good
pigs.
Because that story is in my kids' Bible and they want to know the answer to that.
Generally speaking, what I would argue is that deliverance in the New Testament is relatively unexciting. Mm. I would argue that Jesus does it and the person gets up and everyone's happy. Mm. What you haven't got is 6 hours in a sweaty room with crosses and goat's legs and, you know, weird things like you see on exorcism films. Mm. So I would argue that deliverance, the thing that is the power in deliverance ministry is the name of Jesus. So you pray into that. You challenge the strongholds. First of all, you need someone who discerns. So, you know, discerning spirit. Is this a time to really do deliverance ministry, or is this a time to do just pray a blessing? Then you want to sort of make sure that this is an environment where the person feels comfortable. If it's the kind of situation for deliverance that I expect they will have embarrassed themselves a number of times in public, let's not repeat that. Let's do it somewhere quieter, calmer, probably not at the end of the service, perhaps come back a later time. The power is in the name of Jesus. You do it and you trust God. And then you also acknowledge that even though you perhaps have done the spiritual, there's going to be psychological and social and biological consequences to unpick there as well. In the same way, I will talk about the pigs, you know, and that sort of biopsychosocial thing that illustrates that.
Great. I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll take a break. We're getting loads and loads of really helpful ones about specifics, so what we're going to do with all your questions is we're going to look over them over lunch so that we've then got a panel, and particularly Rob can then choose some specific practical application questions later on. One other just slightly theoretical question. Obviously, we see through history how people have got things wrong, haven't known things, and obviously there's always a danger of living in our own day and being like, look, now we understand it. What do you think we don't know that... Yeah, I mean, I know it's a very hard question. I was just curious.
Yeah, I think, with my sort of doctor hat on, there's a whole bunch of stuff coming out that we will know more. We know that structural scans of the brain don't tell us a great deal. You know, we can see advanced dementia. We can see advanced schizophrenia because there are changes in the brain. But generally speaking, you can't see stuff on structural scans. And what I mean by that is a CT scan or an MRI. What we really need to understand is functional scans, where you can kind of see the brain activity, you know, the bits that are active sort of light up. And I think functional scans are opening up a whole bunch of stuff. We understand much better how systems in the brain work. We will be able to sort of have medications that particularly perhaps just act on one part of the brain. The other thing that we haven't got at the moment is what are called disease-modifying medications. So, for example, if you've got arthritis, in the past you would have got a painkiller. You might have had some slightly fancier things that reduce the inflammation. Gold is one of the treatments for arthritis because it binds up the sort of inflammatory proteins. But nothing changes the arthritis process. And now what we've got is immunology-based treatments in arthritis that actually cure it, really, effectively. And we don't have that. Now, one of the reasons is that it's much easier to get a sample of cartilage than it is a sample of brain. You're probably not going to give me a brain sample. So, you know, we are, I think, behind in our medication. So we've got the first immunological treatments for dementia that actually stop dementia rather than just supporting the remaining neurons. Now, they're really just beginning to come out of the lab. So there's huge changes coming out in science. I think we will have immune therapy for psychosis within my working lifetime. Exactly where depression fits into that, because depression is so complicated, psychological, social, everything else that we've spoken about, I'm not quite sure where we land with that. But there are huge treatments coming out in medicine. I think are going to see. And I think the other thing, what don't we know? There's a huge value, I think, in seeing a really skilled counsellor. Everyone should see a counsellor. I have seen a therapist for a period. Now, I wouldn't give myself a diagnosis of mental illness, but it was hugely helpful to see a spiritual director, whatever you want to say. I think for all of us, you know, spiritual growth is really important. You know, we get sort of so far in life and we sort of done school and then done maybe a bit more study and then we've got a job and we've got married and we've had a couple of kids. And I was like, what's next? Retirement and death. You know, so I think to kind of think that through in your 40s, and that's kind of a bit of what this book's about, is really important. So I think to have a deeper understanding of the personal journey in the church, and that it's not just saved and the only thing that then happens is resurrection. There's growth and discipleship and spiritual maturity along the way.